congratulations to Shar Shemayin for hosting what is certainly the premier adult Jewish education event on the Jewish calendar in Montreal, and for doing it with such creativity every year, and really bringing in hundreds of people, and if not more. And the Shar deserves to be congratulated under the inspired leadership of its rabbi, Rabbi Shire, who's not here to hear that I complimented him. But tell him. Okay. I'm here to talk tonight about an interesting, the topic is Tikkun Olam and its limitations. Tikkun Olam is a phrase I think by this point everyone has heard in different contexts many times. I think there's a general assumption we understand what the words mean. I'm going to spend a little bit of time talking about its origins, talking about its originally intended definition, and what it means today, and how it's used or misused. All right, somebody tell me, what is Tikkun Olam? Someone tell me.
To repair the world.
Okay. Anyone know its origin? What's the origin of the expression?
B'malchut Shaddai.
Okay, you're getting already disputatious and argumentative. But thank you. I'm getting there. You're right. We can skip the next 10 minutes. No, so what's the origin? Where does it come from? No, I don't know. Alice has made a rare error. That's the assumed. I'm going to talk about what's the assumption. Where does it come from? Anyone know? It's from a prayer we recite three times a day. Anyone remember? Yes.
Aleinu.
Right. The Aleinu prayer is the most popularly believed origin of it, although that's not necessarily true. Alice may turn out to be right. We'll see. In Aleinu we say l'takein olam b'malchut Shaddai to. And again, it's translated differently, but to correct or perfect the world, b'malchut Shaddai, which is the part of the sentence that most people either ignore, but most likely are simply ignorant of. It simply says, l'taken olam b'malchut Shaddai, to repair the world under God's sovereignty. The God part is usually left out when the phrase is used properly. We just say, tikkun olam, to repair the world. It is... It's an interesting idea. It's generally used. Hillel Halkin, by the way, I don't know if everyone here, I'm assuming, knows who Hillel Halkin. He's the great translator of Hebrew and Yiddish, a great linguist. He writes a language column every week in the Foreword under an assumed name. And he is a brilliant linguist, and he knows many languages and is a brilliant translator. He says, and he said the following, that Tikkun Olam has been popularly inserted into American language vocabulary as popular as Babel, Schmooze, and Chutzpah. That's what Hillel Halkin said about the expression Tikkun Olam. In 2012, a distinguished leader speaking to a Jewish gathering in Washington said the following, the concept of Tikkun Olam has enriched and guided my life. Anyone want to guess who that was in Washington in 2012? That was President Barack Obama. Barack Obama in 2012, that the concept of Tikkun Olam has enriched his life. Not successfully, but enriched his life. Does anybody here ever watch the show Ray Donovan on Showtime?
Yes.
Who watches the show? Thank you. So as the only person other than me who watches the show on Showtime, I'll explain to you what the show is. It's not a family show. Let me just put it that way. It's a show about Ray Donovan, who's an Irish thug who works in Hollywood as a fixer when actors get themselves in trouble. He's a murderer. He does some nasty things. The nice part about the show is his assistant is an Israeli former army man from Israel named Avi. It's a lot of fun, the show. And the Hollywood producer who employs him is Elliot Gould, plays a Jewish Hollywood producer. At different times during the 2 years of the show, Elliot Gould has ordered people's murders and done some ugly and disgusting things. But at least three times a season, he will turn to Ray and say, but Ray, what about Tikkun Olam? And I'm not sure, and it's not translated in the show. There's just an assumption that Americans understand that this is some kind of well-known Jewish slogan to describe what? Basically social activism. That if you're involved in the environment, you're involved in Tikkun Olam. If you're involved in helping the underprivileged, you're involved in Tikkun Olam. If you're involved in solving whatever social crisis there is at the moment, global warming, you are involved in Tikkun Olam. You are repairing the world. The assumption is that the world is broken and it needs people to fix it. And the word, that we use in now, when the question is, what's the R, where did it come from? When did it start being used this way? Because as you know, as you understand already from the Elenu source, when we say, v'takeno lamba malchut Shaddai, to repair the world under God's sovereignty, the original intent was not exactly social activism or environmentalism. It was a universal plea for God's sovereignty to be palpable and tangible in the world. That is the context of the prayer. And what's interesting about the Elenu prayer, which we're all familiar with, is if you look at it very carefully, by the way, the prayer is a very old prayer. It goes back possibly to the 2nd century. I'd say 3rd century. And the first paragraph is rather parochial and particularistic. The second paragraph has a very universal vision. What do we say, among others? It is our duty, meaning the Jewish duty, to praise God, the Lord of all things, in the opening paragraph, to ascribe greatness to him who formed the world in the beginning, since he hath not made us like the nations of other lands. Shloah, son of right, that's our Jews. He made us very different, right? He made us not like the nations of the world. It didn't place us like other families of the earth, since, except the nations, he has not placed us, since he hath not assigned us a portion as unto them, nor as a lot unto all their multitude. For we bend the knee and offer worship and thanks before the Supreme King of Kings. By the way, there's a censored sentence. As you may know from some prayer books, there's a sentence which was centered out, which we even go further in rejecting the world. We say in the original prayer, Shehem mishtachavim lehevel valik velel lo yoshia. They pray and bend their knee to a God who will not save them. It's a very stridently parochial opening paragraph. And you can understand why it was censored. By the way, in the 11th century, there were Jews who were being martyred at the time of the Crusades and refused to convert. And the popular story is that they went to their death singing Elenu, which makes a lot of sense, right? We reject the other faith. Shehei mishtachavim lehevel valik. We are the ones who pray to the true God. And they were martyred by the river, and they sang Elenu. Popular tradition is that that's when the Elenu prayer was incorporated into the liturgy, into the formal liturgy. It's probably not accurate. We have prayer books from about 100 years before that already have it in the daily liturgy. Although, again, as I said, the prayer predates even that by at least 800 years. But the second paragraph, Alkei Nekavelecha, is a paragraph that has a rather, you know, it switches tone immediately. We therefore hope in thee, O Lord our God. The question is, what does universalism mean? You know, there's a lot of definitions of universalism. Does it mean, you know, the Muslims will tell you they're universalists because they hope for the day when the whole world is Muslim. Is that universalism? In a way, it is. It means they're concerned about us. They want us to have a true faith. But generally speaking, today we use universalism in a different sense. You know, does universalism mean? What does it mean to be universalist? Anyway, we therefore hope in thee, O Lord our God, that we may speedily behold the glory of thy might, when thou wilt remove the abominations from the earth, and the idols will be utterly cut off, when the world will be perfected under the kingdom of the Almighty. That's L'taken Olam B'Malchut Shaddai, to fix the world. This is about getting rid of idol worship, right? Because that's when the prayer was written. It wasn't Christians weren't our competitors, but pagans were. Before thee, O Lord our God, let them bow down and fall. Unto thy glorious name let them give honor. So the second paragraph is about a universal vision of universal monotheism and a rejection of paganism. It's interesting when the phrase is used, however, in the Talmud, that has a very different meaning. There are many. There's a basket full of enactments by the rabbis at the time of the Mishnah, the Talmud, whose purpose it is tikkun olam, to fix the world. It's simply the only difference in the expression. It's not called tikkun olam in the Talmud or the Mishnah. It's called tikkun ha'olam. It's probably not a significant philosophical difference at all. And I'll tell you, for instance, what the examples are. Most of them have to do with divorce law and enhancing the power of a woman in marriage and divorce. And the justification given for the rabbinic intervention in making those decrees, l'taken olam, to fix the world, right? So that these problems shouldn't arise. I'll give you one funny example. According to Jewish law, when a man gives a divorce to a woman, right, the man is the active writer of the get and then gives it to his wife, or soon to be ex-wife. And according to Jewish law, you're permitted, let's say you live in Cleveland and your wife's in Columbus, you can appoint a messenger to take it to Columbus for you. And the messenger gets on his horse in those days and travels to Columbus and delivers the get. Let's say in between, while you're, you know, traveling from Cleveland to Columbus, you change your mind. You say, you know, all right, give it another shot, right? And you want to call back the messenger. Now you don't have a phone, so what do? So you send another messenger to get the other messenger to stop before the get is delivered, right? So you get a faster messenger, and the messenger gets on a faster horse, and it starts running to Columbus to stop the messenger. And but you have to beat him there, right? Because if he is. So there was a method originally where instead of sending a faster messenger to get the first messenger, you walk into your local Beit Din and you say, I nullify the messenger. Right? I nullify the messenger. What's the problem with that? You don't know, right? The messenger gets to Columbus, and before she gets the news that the get was in, she gets remarried and has children, and you got a real problem. So you used to be allowed to nullify a messenger by walking into a court, and that's obviously problematic because it can end up in unintended adultery, and mums and were born, and it's a disaster for everybody. So in order to avoid this, the rabbis took away the power to negate a messenger by going into court. And the reason for that is obvious, but they call that tikkun olam. That's what they call tikkun olam. The other thing the rabbis call tikkun olam is very interesting. And this is a tragedy it's tragic that the rabbis even had to discuss this. One of the other things they discussed was when a Jewish hostage is taken, you are not permitted to pay exorbitant ransom. They don't define exactly what exorbitant is, but say you cannot pay exorbitant ransom because that only encourages further hostage taking. And the reality is this was so prevalent that there's whole bodies of Jewish response about how to respond to this. There's a famous story of the Maharam of Rottenberg who was a rabbi whose community had ransomed him, and he declined to leave because he said, you pay this much, they'll only take more. I mean, this is a dispute going on today between the Brits and the U.S. on the one hand and the Europeans on the other about hostages taken in Syria by ISIS, where the Europeans will pay a ransom and the Americans and the British won't, which is why James Foley and Stephen Sotloff are dead today, because the Americans and the Brits say, short-term, we suffered terrible losses, but we remove the incentive for further hostage-taking. I mean, it's a legitimate debate. So the rabbi said, you are not permitted to pay exorbitant ransom, because that creates just further incentive for hostage-taking. So that's tikkun olam. Another thing the rabbis called tikkun olam was the prusbel. The prusbel is a fascinating law. Hillel enacted this. Hillel came from a very poor family and was therefore very sensitive to the needs of those who were not of means. And the Jewish law says that debts are canceled every seventh year. You may be familiar with the law of the Shemitah. He says, if I borrow money from you and I successfully evade you till Shemitah, the debt is canceled. The debt's canceled. Now, the original intent of the biblical law is to help poor people, right? This way, at a certain point, their debts get canceled. What's the effect of the law because human beings being what they are? The effect of law is the reverse. It impedes the flow of capital to the poor because who's going to lend money to somebody if the debt could be canceled? So a law that the Bible intended to help the poor ended up hurting them because if there's a fear of not being paid back, they don't lend. So it hurts the flow of capital to the underprivileged. So the rabbis instituted prusbel under Hillel, which says you are permitted before the Shemitah year to transfer the burden of your debts to the court. Debts to the court are not canceled, and therefore the poor will still benefit from loans. It was to help the poor. The rabbis put it, shlo tinal delik b'pnei lavin, so that the door isn't locked before borrowers. And the rabbis there said that is tikkun olam. That's to correct the world, right? People use the law, or the effect of the law was to hurt the poor, but it was intended to help the poor, so we fix things. The tikkun olam. The question is, what does it mean today, and what is its definition, and how is it used? It's clear that generally it's used as a way to put a Jewish label on the universalist impulse. That means the desire for Jews to engage in social action is a wonderful thing. Often it is understood by those who elevate tikkun olam as the primary expression of Judaism, that social activism takes primacy over Jewish learning or Jewish ritual life, and the social activism that the Jew is supposed to engage in is given a primary role as part as the expression of their Judaism and as the way to identify the Jews. not, so what happened, basically, and let me just read you the origin of this. It's fascinating. Also, by the way, before I get to that, the word Tikkun Olam is also used in Kabbalah, in mysticism. Kabbalah is, I don't know if anybody listened to Madonna records. If you did, you'll know Kabbalah. Kabbalah is, whatever it is. Anyway, so, but they've explained Kabbalah in 2 minutes. That's funny. Anyway, Kabbalah, there's a concept in Kabbalah called Tikkun. Tikkun is the idea that the world is created when the holy sparks, or when the holiness is contained in vessels, then the vessels break and there are sparks of holiness that fly around the world. And to do Tikkun Olam, you have to collect these holy sparks that are embedded in all these weird places. It's this whole mystical cosmology. The idea is Tikkun, it means you can repair things. You know, it's sometimes used popularly. Let me give you one example, and you'll understand what I mean. Why do we all eat and drink to excess on Purim? Why do we get drunk on Purim? So the popular explanation is it's a tikkun. What's the sin of the Jews of the Purim time that led them to be persecuted? Is they attended a party at the house of King Ahasuerus that was actually intended to celebrate the defeat of the Jews. They participated in this party, which was terribly ugly and bespoke a lack of pride and Jewish dignity. And so we did it wrong. Because we did something wrong, we were punished by the edict to kill us, which thankfully was averted. How do we do a tikkun for that in popular Kabbalistic imagination? We have a party for a good reason, under a Jewish umbrella, to celebrate God's miracles. All right? So it's a tit-for-tat kind of correction. Sometimes this concept was taken to excess. For instance, the time of the false Messiah, Shabtai Tzvi. This is actually a distraction, but Shabtai Tzvi took this mystical idea to excess, where he said these mystical sparks are everywhere, even in sin, and the only way to redeem those sparks is to engage in sin, and he had wild orgies to justify, and used this to justify the orgies that he engaged in. He called it Tikkun Olam. Anyway, nobody in our day does it, you know. That's all we, you know, anyway. Anyway, it's much too just rich, forget it. Anyway, by the way, don't try using the line, it doesn't work. All right. The first use, there was a scholar who tried to figure out when the first time Tikkun Olam was used in North America, the way that we've come to hear it most frequently. The claim is it was used in the 1950s by a man named Shlomo Barden, who was the founder of the Brandeis Camp Institute in California. This became very popular in the 90s. The Pittsburgh platform of the Reform Movement wrote the following: partners with God in Tikkun Olam, repairing the world, right? In other words, that whenever we engage in our social activism of women's rights or gay rights or environmentalism or global warming, whatever it is, that is Tikkun Olam, that is somehow repairing the world. The sad outcome of this, I mean, on the one hand, it's a nice thing. I mean, who can be against social activism? Who can be against helping the poor or any social cause that's legitimate? Who can be against any of it? But many cynics saw this as an attempt to simply put a Hebrew label on what liberal Jews were doing anyway. In other words, social activism became the credo of the great swath of American Jewry. This was their Judaism, or as one person put it, the Reform Movement in America is the Democratic Party with holidays, and this was what they were doing anyway. And let's go out and make people feel good and Jew it up. And they Jewed it up by calling their social activism and giving it a Hebrew name. And people who had never used Hebrew in any other context were all of a sudden going around saying, "Yes, I'm doing Tikkun Olam. I'm doing Tikkun Olam." All right, whatever it is. But there was a way to Jewify what they were already doing. The other interesting consequence, and this Rabbi Sachs and others have pointed out, is that, let me read you what Rabbi Jonathan Sachs said back in the 90s about this. Every phrase associated with the idea of Tikkun Olam, phrases like light unto the nations or the Jewish mission, all these things became code words for assimilation. Reform and the whole concept of Tikkun Olam became suspect. What a tragedy that is. In other words, the unintended consequence of labeling these already ongoing activities on the part of Jews who the Orthodox would say were already on the way to assimilation, already assimilated, was to give Tikkun Olam a bad name in the Orthodox world, where Orthodox Jews who, I don't know if this is true, who would normally engage in social activism, which I'm skeptical about, all of a sudden it becomes a dirty word because, you know, it becomes the signature mission of the less religious, so they call their thing Tikkun Olam. If they're doing it, it must be trained. Because how do Orthodox Jews make up their minds about things? They ask other people who aren't Orthodox to do the opposite. So if they're doing it, it must be wrong. It must be wrong. So that's an interesting unintended consequence. It gave social action in the Orthodox world kind of a bad name. The real question is, cut away all the modern effects of this, is really to ask ourselves a simple question. As Jews, is there an answer to the question, are we universalists? Are we?
Yeah, what is universal?
Okay, let me define it, you're right. Let me put it this way. If you pick up the newspaper, as I did a few years ago, and read the following statistics, is this a source of angst or a source of pride? This is the following statistic. 90% of all charitable gifts of $1 million or more given by American Jews go to non-Jewish charities. Is that good news or bad news? All right? That's a fascinating statistic. 90%, oh no, obviously it can be. 90% is in both, though. 90% of all charitable gifts given by American Jews, 90% go to non-Jewish charities. Now, by the way, I'm even uncomfortable with the word non-Jewish. I mean, I'm not, is a hospital a non, I mean, it's not particularly Jewish, is what I mean. It's not a Jewish institution. It doesn't make it un-Jewish to give to a hospital or to cancer research. I'm just saying it's not a Jewish organization. 90%, that's a fascinating statistic. For some, that's a source of pride. For many, that's a source of, you know, it's a symptom of a larger phenomenon of the Jew who embraces the non-Jewish world or universalism to the detriment of the Jewish world. It is not necessarily you can do both. Absolutely. And that's the question, though. The problem we have, I think, today, I think everyone knows, I don't have to articulate it, is you have Jews who are excessively parochial, and you have Jews who are excessively universalistic in their outlook. We're missing the people in the middle. But it's a challenge. It's a serious challenge. The question is, who are we really? Is there an answer to the question? Is there an answer to the question? What I can tell you is that the question has always been a source of struggle. This is not a new issue. I'll read you a beautiful midrash as an example. Actually, before I read the midrash, I'm a rabbi, so I'll even go with the parsha. The parsha this week talks about Vayera. It's an unbelievable midrash. Again, I'm going to teach you a text that was literally written 1,800 years ago, an explanation of a biblical passage. The biblical passage says the following, that Abraham is sitting at the doorway of his tent in the city of Mamre. Okay. The midrash says, 1,800 years ago, why was he in Mamre? This is the last paragraph of the previous Torah portion was about how Abraham gets circumcised at an advanced age. And now he's sitting outside his tent in the heat of the day in Mamre. The Midrash says, why was he in Mamre? He says, the Midrash says something fascinating. After God told Abraham to get circumcised, he went and asked three of his friends whether he should do this. Should I get circumcised? He didn't have very good friends. They told him yes. Anyway, they told him, yeah, it's a great idea. Anyway, so he went ahead and he got circumcised. And because Mamre, his good friend, gave him advice to get circumcised, the Bible honors Mamre by telling us Abraham wasn't in Mamre's place. So there's a midrash that says he asked these people advice. Now, it's obviously bizarre, right? God tells him to kill his son. He doesn't ask anybody advice. All of a sudden, he tells him to get circumcised. He starts asking advice. I mean, it doesn't make sense. I mean, God told you to do circumcision, and all of a sudden, you're wondering if let me get a second opinion. It's a very strange midrash. But the midrash is telling us something very deep, and I'm going to give you an explanation of the midrash, which is every rabbi has said literally for the last 1,700 years, is the following. You know what Abraham was worried about? Why did he ask his non-Jewish friends whether he should be circumcised? Of course he was going to listen. He was wondering if he looked different, could he still be their friends? That means, does the Jew engaging in an act which separates himself in a very profound way through circumcision from the rest of the world, will that deny Abraham the ability to engage the world? And Abraham was worried that circumcision would cut him off, hey, what a terrible expression, cut him off from the world. That's what he was worried about. So he didn't consult his Shame and Aver and his Jewish friends in the Midrashic lore, but he asked his non-Jewish friends in this Midrashic interpretation. Now, obviously this never happened. Midrash makes up the story. But the Midrash, by telling you the story, is telling you that they understood there's a problem. If we circumcise ourselves, are we so different that we lose our ability to impact the world? This was a concern of the rabbis a long time ago, long before anybody started, you know, using Tikkun Olam the way they use, you know, whatever, to mean different things. Does that hurt us? There's another beautiful midrash, a beautiful midrash. The midrash describes something very interesting. Moses is commanded to build the tabernacle, and he puts up a tabernacle, and it says when Moses finished building the tabernacle in the desert, that the glory of God filled the tabernacle. The midrash wants to know something very important. The midrash asks the following, and says the following. I'm Rabbi Yeshua, and Rabbi Joshua says the name of Rabbi Levi. What is this similar to? Now, what's the concern? If the presence of God is with us, does that mean it's not anywhere else? Are we the only ones who have the presence of God? Do we monopolize the divine presence? If the Bible says that the divine presence fills the tabernacle, does that mean nobody else can think about God? And the Midrash says something beautiful. It says it's like a cave that's on the banks of the ocean. When the tide rises, the water from the ocean fills the cave, but the ocean itself is still full. That's what the tabernacle is. The tabernacle is like the cave, which means the divine presence is everywhere, says the Midrash. But it fills our cave. In other words, the rabbis went out of their way, right? Even this text is 1,500 years old. 1,500 years ago, to try to teach Jews, just because it's with you, doesn't mean it's not anywhere else, right? Which is a very modern idea, that just because we're told we build these holy places and God fills them and everything else, it doesn't mean we're the only ones who have the divine presence. The divine presence fills the world like the oceans, right? And even though we get it, the ocean's not diminished. So that this idea that this, at least in this definition of universalism, where we believe we do not have a monopoly on God, that idea was always present. I'll give you another example. There's a beautiful midrash about the Shema. In the Shema it says the following. We know what we say in the Shema. The midrash, I'll read you the midrash in English. This is a midrash on the Shema. Right here, Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. He is our God, making his name particularly attached to us, but he's also the God of all mankind. As it is said, the Lord shall be king over all the earth. That means just constant reminders of rabbinic literature that we're not exclusive. By the way, I could stand here and give you all the other examples also. I'm not telling you everything in rabbinic literature has a universal vision. I mean, we all prayed on the holidays, and we say, Atar b'chatanu mikol amim, right? You have chosen us from all the nations, right? V'lam tanu mikol ha'loshonot, and elevated us from all the other tongues. Right, the Kiddush Tana, you have sanctified us. There are some very parochial and particularistic messages, like Elena before, but there's a stubborn refusal on the part of the rabbis in the Midrash of the Talmud to ever engage in religious triumphalism or chauvinism, where they insist that although we have, doesn't mean the world does not have. In addition to that, throughout rabbinic literature, there is an insistence on giving charity not only to Jews. It says over and over again, Israel, you're supposed to support the poor of the nations of the world, along with the poor of your own people. And again, this is not from 1950, this is from 650, right? Or even earlier. You have to support the poor of the nations of the world, along with the poor of Israel, because of the ways of peace. Now, admittedly, there's two ways to understand that phrase. Because of the ways of peace. It's a very negative way to look at it, which may be true. I'm not telling you, it's hard to know what it means. One explanation of the Darkei Shalom is that we support the poor of the nations of the world so they don't beat the crap out of us, right? B'nei Darkei Shalom, in order to keep the peace. Others interpret it in a much more positive way, B'nei Darkei Shalom, in order to engender a harmonious society. There are two ways to understand that expression. There are, and I cannot tell you which is authentic. This has been debated as long as Jews have read the sentence. But it does say that we do it. that we do support the poor of the nations of the world, I believe, in the positive definition, in order to enhance the creation of a harmonious society. We do that. We engage in universal social action, right? Long before, again, the 1990s and the Pittsburgh Platform, the Reform Movement, we do this, right? We make Darkei Shalom in order to create that harmonious society. Now, I also just want to give you a couple of examples, and I just have about 20 more minutes, so I'll just cut this down. I was ordered to finish at 8:20. I'll tell you a couple of very interesting stories about the about this impulse and the contrary impulse. You know, if part of the issue is that we Jews, you know, we have the idea of the Messiah is originally a Jewish idea, a beautiful idea, a dangerous idea, but a beautiful idea that we have bequeathed to the world, the Messianic impulse. That Messianic impulse has played itself out in different ways, in different times, in different generations. The idea that the world is perfectible is a very dangerous idea. It's a beautiful idea, but a dangerous idea. I mean, in the communist imagination, if you can perfect the world as a dictatorship of the working class, you know, there's, if you believe that, there's very little you won't do in order to achieve it. I mean, utopianism, it can be very dangerous because every means will be justified in order to achieve that wonderful end. It's a dangerous idea, but again, a beautiful idea if kept in proportion. And we see that all the time, the Messianic impulse. I mean, what college freshman hasn't dreamed of a time when, oh, you know, imagine there is no religion, imagine there are no countries. I mean, John Lennon. Imagine there's nothing that divides us. Imagine there's a universal government. Everybody from the writers of Star Trek to Woodrow Wilson, you know, dreamed of that kind of global government, right, where the differences between people of different skin colors and backgrounds and religions and nationalities and languages are all brought together and there's this harmonious, beautiful world. Everyone has dreamed of that at one time or another. One of the most interesting expressions of that dream took place. I don't know if you've ever been to Warsaw, you've gone to the Jewish cemetery in Warsaw. There's a grave there of a man named Lazar Zamenhof. Does anyone know who Lazar Zamenhof is? Does that name mean anything to anybody? Zamenhof. All right, one person knows. I won't ask you that. Does anyone know who Zamenhof is? Ludwig was his Russian name. He was a Litvak. Ludwig Zamenhof. You know who he was. We have one. Okay. His grave is in the Warsaw Cemetery. You'll forgive me. I'll explain who he was. It's a very interesting story. Ludwig Zamenhof was a fascinating figure. He was born in 1859 and died in April 1917. He was a dreamer. He was the archetype, the classical Jewish universalist, the one who, if he knew what the expression meant or heard its modern usage, would have been the poster child for Tikkun Olam. He started his life. He was an ophthalmologist. He was born, I believe, in Bialystok. He was born in Bialystok when it was the Russian partition. He created a language. He's one of the few people in the world that created language. Most languages grow organically. He created a language. He created a language called Esperanto. Esperanto is a word you've heard. Esperanto is a fascinating language. Now, let me read you a little bit about why Esperanto was created. Esperanto was the instinct of this man, Lazar Zamenhof. Let me read you something he wrote in 1895. The place where I was born and spent my childhood and gave direction to all my future struggles in Bialystok, the inhabitants were divided into four distinct elements, Russians, Poles, Germans, and Jews. Each of these spoke their own language and looked upon all others as enemies. In such a town, a sensitive nature feels more acutely than elsewhere the misery caused by language division, and sees at every step that the diversity of languages, the PQ never read this, the diversity of languages, or at least the most influential basis for the separation of the human family into groups of enemies. I was brought up as an idealist. I was taught that all people are brothers. While outside in the street at every step, I felt that there were no people, only Russians, Poles, Germans, Jews, and so on. This was always a torment to my infant mind. And although many people may smile at such an anguish for the world and a child, since at that time I thought that grown-ups were omnipotent, so I often said to myself that when I grew up, I would certainly destroy this evil. Those are the words written in 1895 by Lazar Zamenhof. Originally, he was a Zionist, by the way, but he flirted with Zionism and then abandoned it. And when he abandoned it, he said the following. He says, I am profoundly convinced that every nationalism offers humanity only the greatest of happiness. It is true that the nationalism of oppressed people, as a natural self-defensive reaction, is much more excusable than the nationalism of peoples who oppress. But if the nationalism of the strong is ignoble, then the nationalism of the weak is imprudent. Both give birth to and support each other. That's when he abandoned Zionism. Interestingly, before he created Esperanto, he was an advocate of changing the alphabet, the Yiddish alphabet, into a Latin alphabet. He wanted Yiddish written in a Latin alphabet, which I guess it is today anyway. Zamenhof created a language, and it's interesting. He himself abandoned Judaism. He was a universalist. By the way, Esperanto is not a forgotten language. Esperanto today is spoken between Wikipedia. This is all from Wikipedia, this part, so I don't know how, you know. They estimate, and I've seen this elsewhere, between 100,000 and 2 million. I know that's a wide spell. But speak Esperanto. But there are, if you go on the internet, you'll see there are whole societies in Europe. There's a school in San Marino that literally engaged in Esperanto. The idea was that if we have a universal language, all divisions between people would be eliminated. That was his dream. It was a beautiful universalistic dream, a very Jewish dream in many ways, taken to an extreme, where we could create this harmonious world through the use of one language that is universal. Zamenhof. Tragedy of Zamenhof's life, he had three children. I recently found a used Jewish book that I never knew existed. It's a book about this thick. It's a book that's simply a listing with brief biographical vignettes about all the Jewish doctors in Poland who were murdered during the Holocaust. It's a book this thick. And the three of his children, Zamenhof's three children, were murdered in the Holocaust. That means, you know, I don't know, you know, I guess one could say that the Holocaust repudiated his universalistic naivete, and others would say it confirmed the need for it, however you want to interpret it. But that was the reality of Zamenhof's life, and he's buried in the Warsaw Cemetery. That's the Jewish universalist impulse. That's tikkun olam taken to a serious extreme, where you want to erase all differences. I mean, my father, of blessed memory, used to tell me as a kid, the story when he was a kid, about 8 or 9 years old, walking home from shul on a Shabbos morning in Velizh, then under communist rule in the Soviet Union. This is the 1920s, and my grandfather, Rabbi Eliezer Pupko, was the rabbi of the community, and he witnessed as two young Jewish communists, members of the Jewish wing of the Communist Party, the Asexia, who were committed to world peace and world harmony, were dragging a Jewish widow out of her house and shot her dead in front of her two children because she had violated the sugar rations under Lenin. And that's the flip side of utopianism, where you believe you can do anything in order to usher in a perfect world. That's the danger of the utopianism. But I want to tell you another story also. It's an interesting story. Everyone knows who created the polio vaccine. Many of you in this room are old enough to remember the world before a polio vaccine. Saul, a wonderful Jew. How much the world changed after the polio vaccine. My father had polio as a kid, not seriously, walked with limp his whole life. My older brother, who's 12 years older than me, born in 1946, remembers still the summer restrictions on swimming to avoid polio. I was born in 58, by that time it was all behind us in that short time period. And that was a great, great intervention. How many here, however, in this room, heard of a Jewish doctor whose work in vaccination preceded Salk's and was certainly more effective than Salk's? Whoever heard of Dr. Hofkin? Has anyone here ever heard of Dr. Hofkin? I want to tell you a fascinating story. And this is, I think, an example of Tikkun Olam at its best. Hofkin is really a story that, you know, people who know his story and doctors who have studied his story and his effect, Waldemar Hofkin was a man who was born in the Ukraine in 1860. He was advancing in science in the late 19th century in the Ukraine. His name was Hofkin. He was offered a very high position under the Tsar, with the condition that he convert to Russian Orthodoxy. There are a lot of stories about why he didn't convert. Certain Hasidic movements have kidnapped him and made him part of their story. I won't get into who it was because I'm a very positive person. But it's somehow or another he had an encounter with a rabbi on a train. It's goes some stories. I don't know what story is accurate, but we know what happened. He refused to convert. He ended up moving to India. If you go to India today in Mumbai, there's a Hofkin Institute store. Now, let me tell you what he did. And he was knighted by Queen Victoria. Let me read you what was said about him in 1897 when he was knighted by the Queen. The Jewish Chronicle of the time noted a Russian Jew trained in the schools of European science saves the lives of helpless Hindus and Mohammedans and is decorated by the descendant of William the Conqueror and Alfred the Great. Now, that's what was written in 1897 about him. He was the one who stopped cholera epidemics. He created the cholera vaccine in 1893. He developed a cholera vaccine. And how did he test the cholera vaccine back in 1892? I know people don't believe there were real doctors doing real things in 1892, but there were. How did he test it? He tested it on himself. He tested the cholera vaccine on himself. Now, if you know anything about cholera, you'll know how many people's lives he has saved. I don't think there's anybody in the world who can claim to have saved as many lives as this Orthodox Jewish doctor from the Ukraine, Vladimir Hofkin. It's an unbelievable story. Not only did he create the cholera vaccine, he created, there was still in those days the bubonic plague struck Mumbai. The government asked Hofkin to help. He embarked upon the development of a vaccine in a makeshift laboratory in the court of the Great Medical College. In 3 months of work, listen to what he did in 3 months. It's in 1897. One of his assistants had a nervous breakdown, and two others quit. He worked day and night for 3 months, found a vaccine for the bubonic plague, tested it on himself, and stopped the bubonic plague. Now, what's interesting is, in 1902, 19 Indian villagers who were inoculated from a single bottle of vaccine with a tainted needle, by the way, that's what happened, died of tetanus. They called it the little Dreyfus affair because he was nearly put to death. They accused of having killed him with the vaccine. It's a fascinating little Dreyfus affair, and they used to call it. And finally, thank God there was intervention, and the charges against him were disproven. This man literally saved millions of lives. It's interesting. He amongst all his scientific work, amongst everything else. By the way, in 1898, he approached Aga Khan III with an offer for Sultan Abdul Hamid to resettle Jews in Palestine, then a province of the Ottoman Empire. And he was a great, great activist for early Zionism as well. In addition to that, he was deeply troubled. Again, we think everything that happens to us happens for the first time. He was very concerned about young Jews of his generation abandoning traditional Jewish life. He wrote a very long book called In Defense of Judaism. A beautiful book. I mean, it's still available. You can find it. Beautiful book. So, you know, somebody asked before, can you do both? And the answer is yes. And the problem that we have today is we have these extremes. We have the extremes of the Jew who believes that the very definition of Judaism is simply universalism. That is the end-all and be-all of Jewish identity. That if you're involved in social action, that is not just an expression of Judaism, but the highest expression of Judaism. And then you have Jews on the other side for whom any involvement with the non-Jewish world is suspect, that any involvement in the charities that are of non-Jewish nature are suspect and to be left aside, and they engage only in their own. And the reality is that, as the Midrash taught us, you know, we are part of this world, and that we are here and we are obligated not only to ourselves, but we are obligated to everybody. We happen also to believe that the best way to be a universalist is to be deeply steeped in your own Judaism and not simply to lead by example, which is a wonderful thing to do, but that's insufficient. But to lead also by doing is to create, firstly, beautiful Jewish communities, which do hopefully serve as an example to others, but then not to be satisfied with that, but to take it one step further and into the entire world. If your moral vision doesn't begin with the Jewish people, there's something wrong. But if it also ends with the Jewish people, there's also something wrong. It has to begin there, but then it has to grow from there. And that's a balance that's very hard to strike. But the use and the misuses of Tikkun Olam in its varied ways, whether it's in legalistic ways, or liturgical, or Kabbalistic, or in social action, the Tikkun Olam, to correct the world. To correct the world means to do it, however, Jewishly, right? With Jewish ideas, and with Jewish ethics, and with Jewish knowledge. Tikkun Olam, that is simply the progressive agenda, loses any beautiful fragrance of Jewish life. You have to have, again, the Jewish life. You have to have the intensity and the passion of Jewish life and Jewish learning and text and ritual and all those things, and take that wonderful passion and take it to the world. That's what Tikkun Olam at its best can be. If it's simply a way to amputate study and ritual away from Judaism and to make it, you know, just to have an agenda of social action is insufficient and it withers and dies. To live a Jewish life, but to be cloistered in that Jewish life, is also to deny a central message of Judaism, a central universalistic vision of Judaism, and it denies the world the blessings of our teachings, the blessings of our ethics, and the blessings of our lives. You know, it's interesting, just to conclude, I'll read you a speech that Natan Sharansky gave. It's on a similar idea, a little bit different. He wrote about how he gave a speech a couple years ago, in 2009, about, and when he was in the Soviet Union, he had two struggles. There was the Jewish struggle for Aliyah, and there was the universal struggle for human rights. And he says, he writes about himself, he said, this was a speech, "For years I had been a foot soldier in both these great wars." And then he writes, "Today we live in the global, post-national, post-modern, post-identity world where people of the free world again are asked to make a choice between universalism and nationalism, between freedom and identity. If you believe in the universal values of freedom and human rights, why bother to stick to your national or ethnic identity," we are asked. "The question hits home especially in a difficult way for Jews. Doesn't Judaism prize Tikkun Olam, perfection of the world at large, as its highest values? If we insist on being part of a Jewish state, does that make a mockery of our larger universal ideals? If so, do we really want to shelter ourselves in a Jewish cocoon of a state? Why insist on staying part of a small tribe when the great global melting pot makes nationality seem like nothing more than sentimental reminiscences? When one young Jew believes that he or she must make a choice, that you cannot belong to both, they make the choice in favor of universalism. And then assimilation erodes our communities. And then it becomes more and more difficult for the people of Israel to defend their Jewish state." And he goes on. In other words, if you insist on making a choice and not believing you can do both, you end up choosing the universalism to the detriment of the Jewish people, the detriment of our own Jewish identity. Anyway, I have 2 minutes for questions if you want, or it's 8:18. If anybody wants one quick question, Harold, go ahead.
Rabbi, it appears from the examples you've given us that Tikkun Olam is not limited to doing good things within the Jewish world. My question is it an analogous concept to some of the other religions?
Yes. No and yes. That means other faiths certainly do have the concept of helping everyone, yes. Christianity especially. I'm more familiar with Christianity with Islam.
Okay, we didn't introduce Rabbi Pupko, but I'm certainly going to thank him. As always, he's given a very nuanced and informative and insightful talk. And as he was talking, I was thinking perhaps there's lessons learned from, you know, the first Jew, Abraham, because in many ways he was a great humanistic, warm, kind-hearted person who fought God for Sodom. Because aren't there some righteous there? They were not Jews, and he took the fight, you know, to an extreme. And yet, he also could be exclusive and push away. Listen to Sarah and exclude Ishmael from the inheritance, get him out of the house. And then when he wanted to marry, you know, my son's getting married in a week and a half's time. It's so important, little do they know, who they're going to marry. So his son Isaac, what does he do? He just doesn't let him. He's going to very carefully control who, what area. So there's exclusive, and yet there's the universal. So I want to thank Rabbi Pupko, and I think it was great. Thank you.